This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment by Robert Wright. Read by Fred Sanders. For Terry, Mike, Becky, and Linda. Writer, but tell me before you go, what was the worst thing about being down here? Agnes, just existing, knowing my sight was blurred by my eyes, my hearing dulled by my ears, and my bright thought trapped in the gray maze of a brain. Have you seen a brain? Writer, and you're telling me that's what's wrong with us? How else can we be? A Dream Play by August Strindberg, as adapted by Carol Churchill. A note to listeners. Any book with a title like Why Buddhism is True should have some careful qualification somewhere along the way. We might as well get that over with. 1. I'm not talking about the supernatural or more exotically metaphysical parts of Buddhism, reincarnation, for example, but rather about the naturalistic parts, ideas that fall squarely within modern psychology and philosophy. That said, I am talking about some of Buddhism's more extraordinary, even radical claims. Claims that, if you take them seriously, could revolutionize your view of yourself and of the world. This book is intended to get you to take these claims seriously. 2. I'm of course aware that there's no one Buddhism, but rather various Buddhist traditions, which differ on all kinds of doctrines. But this book focuses on a kind of common core, fundamental ideas that are found across the major Buddhist traditions, even if they get different degrees of emphasis, and may assume somewhat different form in different traditions. 3. I'm not getting into super fine-grained parts of Buddhist psychology and philosophy. For example, the Abhidhamma Pitaka, a collection of early Buddhist texts, asserts that there are 89 kinds of consciousness, 12 of which are unwholesome. You may be relieved to hear that this book will spend no time trying to evaluate that claim. 4. I realize that true is a tricky word, and asserting the truth of anything, certainly including deep ideas in philosophy or psychology, is a tricky business. In fact, one big lesson from Buddhism is to be suspicious of the intuition that your ordinary way of perceiving the world brings you the truth about it. Some early Buddhist writings go so far as to raise doubts about whether such a thing as truth ultimately exists. On the other hand, the Buddha, in his most famous sermon, lays out what are commonly called the Four Noble Truths, so it's not as if the word true has no place in discussions of Buddhist thought. In any event, I'll try to proceed with appropriate humility and nuance as I make my argument that Buddhism's diagnosis of the human predicament is fundamentally correct, and that its prescription is deeply valid and urgently important. 5. Asserting the validity of core Buddhist ideas doesn't necessarily say anything, one way or the other, about other spiritual or philosophical traditions. There will sometimes be logical tension between a Buddhist idea and an idea in another tradition, but often there won't be. The Dalai Lama has said, "Don't try to use what you learn from Buddhism to be a better Buddhist. Use it to be a better whatever you already are." Robert Wright. 1. Taking the Red Pill. At the risk of overdramatizing the human condition, have you ever seen the movie The Matrix? It's about a guy named Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, who discovers that he's been inhabiting a dream world. The life he thought he was living is actually an elaborate hallucination. He's having that hallucination while, unbeknownst to him, his actual physical body is inside a gooey, coffin-sized pod, one among many pods, rows and rows of pods, each pod containing a human being absorbed in a dream. These people have been put in their pods by robot overlords and given dream lives as pacifiers. The choice faced by Neo, to keep living a delusion or wake up to reality, is famously captured in the movie's Red Pill scene. Neo has been contacted by rebels who have entered his dream, or, strictly speaking, whose avatars have entered his dream. Their leader, Morpheus, played by Lawrence Fishburne, explains the situation to Neo. "You are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, into a prison that you cannot taste or see or touch, a prison for your mind. The prison is called the Matrix, but there's no way to explain to Neo what the Matrix ultimately is. The only way to get the whole picture, says Morpheus, is to see it for yourself." He offers Neo two pills, a red one and a blue one. Neo can take the blue pill and return to his dream world, or take the red pill and break through the shroud of delusion. Neo chooses the red pill. That's a pretty stark choice, a life of delusion and bondage, or a life of insight and freedom. In fact, it's a choice so dramatic that you'd think a Hollywood movie is exactly where it belongs, that the choices we really get to make about how to live our lives are less momentous than this, more pedestrian. Yet when the movie came out, a number of people saw it as mirroring a choice they had actually made. The people I'm talking about are what you might call Western Buddhists, people in the United States and other Western countries who, for the most part, didn't grow up Buddhist, but at some point adopted Buddhism. At least they adopted a version of Buddhism, a version that had been stripped of some supernatural elements typically found in Asian Buddhism, such as belief in reincarnation and in various deities. This Western Buddhism centers on a part of Buddhist practice that in Asia is more common among monks than among lay people: meditation, along with immersion in Buddhist philosophy. Two of the most common Western conceptions of Buddhism, that it's atheistic and that it revolves around meditation, are wrong. Most Asian Buddhists do believe in gods, though not an omnipotent creator god, and don't meditate. These Western Buddhists, long before they watched The Matrix, had become convinced that the world as they had once seen it was a kind of illusion, not an out-and-out hallucination, but a seriously warped picture of reality that in turn warped their approach to life, with bad consequences for them and the people around them. Now they felt that, thanks to meditation and Buddhist philosophy, they were seeing things more clearly. Among these people, The Matrix seemed an apt allegory of the transition they'd undergone, and so became known as a Dharma movie. The word Dharma has several meanings, including the Buddha's teachings and the path that Buddhists should tread in response to those teachings. In the wake of The Matrix, a new shorthand for "I follow the Dharma" came into currency. I took the red pill. I saw The Matrix in 1999, right after it came out, and some months later I learned that I had a kind of connection to it. The movie's directors, the Wachowski siblings, had given Keanu Reeves three books to read in preparation for playing Neo. One of them was a book I had written a few years earlier, The Moral Animal, Evolutionary Psychology and Everyday Life. I'm not sure what kind of link the director saw between my book and The Matrix, but I know what kind of link I see. Evolutionary psychology can be described in various ways, and here's one way I had described it in my book. It is the study of how the human brain was designed by natural selection to mislead us, even enslave us. Don't get me wrong, natural selection has its virtues, and I'd rather be created by it than not be created at all, which, so far as I can tell, are the two options this universe offers. Being a product of evolution is by no means entirely a story of enslavement and delusion. Our evolved brains empower us in many ways, and they often bless us with a basically accurate view of reality. Still, ultimately, natural selection cares about only one thing, or I should say, cares, in quotes, about only one thing, since natural selection is just a blind process, not a conscious designer. And that one thing is getting genes into the next generation. Genetically based traits that in the past contributed to genetic proliferation have flourished, while traits that didn't have fallen by the wayside. And the traits that have survived this test include mental traits, structures and algorithms that are built into the brain and shape our everyday experience. So if you ask the question, what kinds of perceptions and thoughts and feelings guide us through life each day? The answer, at the most basic level, isn't the kinds of thoughts and feelings and perceptions that give us an accurate picture of reality. No, at the most basic level, the answer is the kinds of thoughts and feelings and perceptions that helped our ancestors get genes into the next generation. Whether those thoughts and feelings and perceptions give us a true view of reality is, strictly speaking, beside the point. As a result, they sometimes don't. Our brains are designed to, among other things, delude us. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Some of my happiest moments have come from delusion, believing, for example, that the tooth fairy would pay me a visit after I lost a tooth. But delusion can also produce bad moments, and I don't just mean moments that, in retrospect, are obviously delusional, like horrible nightmares. I also mean moments that you might not think of as delusional, such as lying awake at night with anxiety, or feeling hopeless, even depressed, for days on end, or feeling bursts of hatred toward people, bursts that may actually feel good for a moment, but slowly corrode your character, or feeling bursts of hatred toward yourself, or feeling greedy, feeling a compulsion to buy things or eat things or drink things well beyond the point where your well-being is served. Though these feelings, anxiety, despair, hatred, greed, aren't delusional the way a nightmare is delusional, if you examine them closely, you'll see that they have elements of delusion, elements you'd be better off without. And if you think you would be better off, imagine how the whole world would be. After all, feelings like despair and hatred and greed can foster wars and atrocities. So if what I'm saying is true, if these basic sources of human suffering and human cruelty are indeed in large part the product of delusion, there is value in exposing this delusion to the light. Sounds logical, right? But here's a problem that I started to appreciate shortly after I wrote my book about evolutionary psychology. The exact value of exposing a delusion to the light depends on what kind of light you're talking about. Sometimes, understanding the ultimate source of your suffering doesn't, by itself, help very much. An everyday delusion. Let's take a simple but fundamental example. Eating some junk food, feeling briefly satisfied, and then, only minutes later, feeling a kind of crash and maybe a hunger for more junk food. This is a good example to start with for two reasons. First, it illustrates how subtle our delusions can be. There's no point in the course of eating a six-pack of small powdered sugar donuts when you're believing that you're the Messiah or that foreign agents are conspiring to assassinate you. And that's true of many sources of delusion that I'll discuss in this book. They're more about illusion, about things not being quite what they seem, than about delusion, in the more dramatic sense of that word. Still, by the end of the book, I'll have argued that all of these illusions do add up to a very large-scale warping of reality, a disorientation that is as significant and consequential as out-and-out delusion. The second reason junk food is a good example to start with is that it's fundamental to the Buddha's teachings. Okay, it can't be literally fundamental to the Buddha's teachings, because 2,500 years ago, when the Buddha taught, junk food as we know it didn't exist. What's fundamental to the Buddha's teachings is the general dynamic of being powerfully drawn to sensory pleasure that winds up being fleeting at best. One of the Buddha's main messages was that the pleasures we seek evaporate quickly and leave us thirsting for more. We spend our time looking for the next gratifying thing, the next powdered sugar donut, the next sexual encounter, the next status-enhancing promotion, the next online purchase. But the thrill always fades, and it always leaves us wanting more. The old Rolling Stones lyric, "I can't get no satisfaction," is, according to Buddhism, the human condition. Indeed, though the Buddha is famous for asserting that life is pervaded by suffering, Some scholars say that's an incomplete rendering of his message, and that the word translated as suffering, dukkha, could, for some purposes, be translated as unsatisfactoriness. So what exactly is the illusory part of pursuing donuts or sex or consumer goods or a promotion? There are different illusions associated with different pursuits, but for now we can focus on one illusion that's common to these things, the overestimation of how much happiness they'll bring. Again, by itself this is delusional only in a subtle sense. If I asked you whether you thought that getting that next promotion or getting an A on that next exam or eating that next powdered sugar donut would bring you eternal bliss, you'd say no, obviously not. On the other hand, we do often pursue such things with, at the very least, an unbalanced view of the future. We spend more time envisioning the perks that a promotion will bring than envisioning the headaches it will bring. And there may be an unspoken sense that once we've achieved this long-sought goal, once we've reached the summit, we'll be able to relax, or at least things will be enduringly better. Similarly, when we see that donut sitting there, we immediately imagine how good it tastes, not how intensely we'll want another donut only moments after eating it, or how we'll feel a bit tired or agitated later, when the sugar rush subsides. Why pleasure fades. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to explain why this sort of distortion would be built into human anticipation. It just takes an evolutionary biologist, or for that matter, anyone willing to spend a little time thinking about how evolution works. Here's the basic logic. We were designed by natural selection to do certain things that helped our ancestors get their genes into the next generation. Things like eating, having sex, earning the esteem of other people, and outdoing rivals. I put designed in quotation marks because, again, natural selection isn't a conscious, intelligent designer, but an unconscious process. Still, natural selection does create organisms that look as if they're the product of a conscious designer, a designer who kept fiddling with them to make them effective gene propagators. So, as a kind of thought experiment, it's legitimate to think of natural selection as a designer and put yourself in its shoes and ask, if you were designing organisms to be good at spreading their genes, how would you get them to pursue the goals that further this cause? In other words, granted that eating, having sex, impressing peers, and besting rivals helped our ancestors spread their genes, how exactly would you design their brains to get them to pursue these goals? I submit that at least three basic principles of design would make sense. 1. Achieving these goals should bring pleasure, since animals, including humans, tend to pursue things that bring pleasure. 2. The pleasure shouldn't last forever. After all, if the pleasure didn't subside, we'd never seek it again. Our first meal would be our last, because hunger would never return. So too with sex. A single act of intercourse, and then a lifetime of lying there, basking in the afterglow. That's no way to get lots of genes into the next generation. 3. The animal's brain should focus more on, 1, the fact that pleasure will accompany the reaching of a goal, than on, 2, the fact that the pleasure will dissipate shortly thereafter. After all, if you focus on 1, you'll pursue things like food and sex and social status with unalloyed gusto, whereas if you focus on 2, you could start feeling ambivalence. You might, for example, start asking what the point is of so fiercely pursuing pleasure if the pleasure will wear off shortly after you get it and leave you hungering for more. Before you know it, you'll be full of ennui and wishing you'd majored in philosophy. If you put these three principles of design together, you get a pretty plausible explanation of the human predicament as diagnosed by the Buddha. Yes, as he said, pleasure is fleeting, and yes, this leaves us recurrently dissatisfied. And the reason is that pleasure is designed by natural selection to evaporate, so that the ensuing dissatisfaction will get us to pursue more pleasure. Natural selection doesn't want us to be happy, after all. It just wants us to be productive, in its narrow sense of productive. And the way to make us productive is to make the anticipation of pleasure very strong, but the pleasure itself not very long-lasting. Scientists can watch this logic play out at the biochemical level by observing dopamine, a neurotransmitter that is correlated with pleasure and the anticipation of pleasure. In one seminal study, they took monkeys and monitored dopamine-generating neurons as drops of sweet juice fell onto the monkeys' tongues. Predictably, dopamine was released right after the juice touched the tongue. But then the monkeys were trained to expect drops of juice after a light turned on. As the trials proceeded, more and more of the dopamine came when the light turned on, and less came after the juice hit the tongue. We have no way of knowing for sure what it felt like to be one of those monkeys, but it would seem that, as time passed, there was more in the way of anticipating the pleasure that would come from the sweetness, yet less in the way of pleasure actually coming from the sweetness. To translate this conjecture into everyday human terms, if you encounter a new kind of pleasure, if, say, you've somehow gone your whole life without eating a powdered sugar donut and somebody hands you one and suggests you try it, you'll get a big blast of dopamine after the taste of the donut sinks in. But later, once you're a confirmed powdered sugar donut eater, the lion's share of the dopamine spike comes before you actually bite into the donut, as you're staring longingly at it. The amount that comes after the bite is much less than the amount you got after that first blissful bite into a powdered sugar donut. The pre-bite dopamine blast you're now getting is the promise of more bliss, and the post-bite drop in dopamine is, in a way, the breaking of the promise. Or at least, it's a kind of biochemical acknowledgement that there was some overpromising. To the extent that you bought the promise, anticipated greater pleasure than would be delivered by the consumption itself, you have been, if not deluded in the strong sense of that term, at least misled. Kind of cruel, in a way, but what do you expect from natural selection? Its job is to build machines that spread genes, and if that means programming some measure of illusion into the machines, then illusion there will be. Unhelpful insights. So this is one kind of light science can shed on an illusion. Call it Darwinian light. By looking at things from the point of view of natural selection, we see why the illusion would be built into us, and we have more reason than ever to see that it is an illusion. But, and this is the main point of this little digression, this kind of light is of limited value if your goal is to actually liberate yourself from the illusion. Don't believe me? Try this simple experiment. 1. Reflect on the fact that our lust for donuts and other sweet things is a kind of illusion, that the lust implicitly promises more enduring pleasure than will result from succumbing to it, while blinding us to the letdown that may ensue. 2. As you're reflecting on this fact, hold a powdered sugar donut 6 inches from your face. Do you feel the lust for it magically weakening? Not if you're like me. No. This is what I discovered after immersing myself in evolutionary psychology. Knowing the truth about your situation, at least in the form that evolutionary psychology provides it, doesn't necessarily make your life any better. In fact, it can actually make it worse. You're still stuck in the natural human cycle of ultimately futile pleasure-seeking, what psychologists sometimes call the hedonic treadmill. But now you have new reason to see the absurdity of it. In other words, now you see that it's a treadmill specifically designed to keep you running, often without really getting anywhere, yet you keep running. And powdered sugar donuts are just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, the truth is, it's not all that uncomfortable to be aware of the Darwinian logic behind your lack of dietary self-discipline. In fact, you may find in this logic a comforting excuse. It's hard to fight Mother Nature, right? But evolutionary psychology also made me more aware of how illusion shapes other kinds of behavior, such as the way I treat other people and the way I, in various senses, treat myself. In these realms, Darwinian self-consciousness was sometimes very uncomfortable. Yonge Mingyur Rinpoche, a meditation teacher in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, has said, "Ultimately, Happiness comes down to choosing between the discomfort of becoming aware of your mental afflictions and the discomfort of being ruled by them. What he meant is that if you want to liberate yourself from the parts of the mind that keep you from realizing true happiness, you have to first become aware of them, which can be unpleasant. Okay, fine. That's a form of painful self-consciousness that would be worthwhile, the kind that leads ultimately to deep happiness. But the kind I got from evolutionary psychology was the worst of both worlds, the painful self-consciousness without the deep happiness. I had both the discomfort of being aware of my mental afflictions and the discomfort of being ruled by them. Jesus said, "I am the way and the truth and the life." Well, with evolutionary psychology, I felt I had found the truth, but manifestly, I had not found the way. Which was enough to make me wonder about another thing Jesus said, that the truth will set you free. I felt I had seen the basic truth about human nature, and I saw more clearly than ever how various illusions imprisoned me, but this truth wasn't amounting to a get-out-of-jail-free card. So is there another version of the truth out there that would set me free? No, I don't think so. At least, I don't think there is an alternative to the truth presented by science. Natural selection, like it or not, is the process that created us. But some years after writing The Moral Animal, I did start to wonder if there was a way to operationalize the truth. A way to put the actual scientific truth about human nature and the human condition into a form that would not just identify and explain the illusions we labor under, but would also help us liberate ourselves from them. I started wondering if this Western Buddhism I was hearing about might be that way. Maybe many of the Buddha's teachings were saying essentially the same thing modern psychological science says, and maybe meditation was in large part a different way of appreciating these truths, and in addition, a way of actually doing something about them. So in August 2003, I headed to rural Massachusetts for my first silent meditation retreat, a whole week devoted to meditation and devoid of such distractions as email, news from the outside world, and speaking to other human beings. The truth about mindfulness. You could be excused for doubting that a retreat like this would yield anything very dramatic or profound. The retreat was, broadly speaking, in the tradition of mindfulness meditation, the kind of meditation that was starting to catch on in the West and that in the years since has gone mainstream. As commonly described, mindfulness, the thing mindfulness meditation aims to cultivate, isn't very deep or exotic. To live mindfully is to pay attention to be mindful of, what's happening in the here and now, and to experience it in a clear, direct way, unclouded by various mental obfuscations. Stop and smell the roses. This is an accurate description of mindfulness as far as it goes, but it doesn't go very far. Mindfulness, as popularly conceived, is just the beginning of mindfulness. And it's in some ways a misleading beginning. If you delve into ancient Buddhist writings, you won't find a lot of exhortations to stop and smell the roses. And that's true even if you focus on those writings that feature the word sati, the word that's translated as mindfulness. Indeed, sometimes these writings seem to carry a very different message. The ancient Buddhist text, known as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the closest thing there is to a Bible of mindfulness, reminds us that our bodies are full of various kinds of unclean things, and instructs us to meditate on such bodily ingredients as feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, skin oil, saliva, mucus, fluid in the joints, urine. It also calls for us to imagine our bodies 1 day, 2 days, 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and festering. I'm not aware of any best-selling books on mindfulness meditation called Stop and Smell the Feces, and I've never heard a meditation teacher recommend that I meditate on my bile, phlegm, and pus, or on the rotting corpse that I will someday be. What is presented today as an ancient meditative tradition is actually a selective rendering of an ancient meditative tradition, in some cases, carefully manicured. There's no scandal here. There's nothing wrong with modern interpreters of Buddhism being selective, even sometimes creative, in what they present as Buddhism. All spiritual traditions evolve, adapting to time and place, and the Buddhist teachings that find an audience today in the United States and Europe are a product of such evolution. The main thing, for our purposes, is that this evolution, the evolution that has produced a distinctly Western, 21st century version of Buddhism, hasn't severed the connection between current practice and ancient thought. Modern mindfulness meditation isn't exactly the same as ancient mindfulness meditation, but the two share a common philosophical foundation. If you follow the underlying logic of either of them far enough, you will find a dramatic claim that we are, metaphorically speaking, living in the matrix. However mundane mindfulness meditation may sometimes sound, it is a practice that, if pursued rigorously, can let you see what Morpheus says the red pill will let you see. Namely, how deep the rabbit hole goes. On that first meditation retreat, I had some pretty powerful experiences. Powerful enough to make me want to see just how deep the rabbit hole goes. So I read more about Buddhist philosophy and talked to experts on Buddhism, and eventually went on more meditation retreats and established a daily meditation practice. All of this made it clearer to me why The Matrix had come to be known as a Dharma movie. Though evolutionary psychology had already convinced me that people are by nature pretty deluded, Buddhism, it turned out, painted an even more dramatic picture. In the Buddhist view, the delusion touches everyday perceptions and thoughts in ways subtler and more pervasive than I had imagined, and in ways that made sense to me. In other words, this kind of delusion, it seemed to me, could be explained as the natural product of a brain that had been engineered by natural selection. The more I looked into Buddhism, the more radical it seemed, but the more I examined it in the light of modern psychology, the more plausible it seemed. The real-life matrix, the one in which we're actually embedded, came to seem more like the one in the movie, not quite as mind-bending maybe, but profoundly deceiving and ultimately oppressive, and something that humanity urgently needs to escape. The good news is the other thing I came to believe. If you want to escape from the matrix, Buddhist practice and philosophy offer powerful hope. Buddhism isn't alone in this promise. There are other spiritual traditions that address the human predicament with insight and wisdom. But Buddhist meditation, along with its underlying philosophy, addresses that predicament in a strikingly direct and comprehensive way. Buddhism offers an explicit diagnosis of the problem and a cure. And the cure, when it works, brings not just happiness, but clarity of vision, the actual truth about things, or at least something way, way closer to that than our everyday view of them. Some people who have taken up meditation in recent years have done so for essentially therapeutic reasons. They practice mindfulness-based stress reduction or focus on some specific personal problem. They may have no idea that the kind of meditation they're practicing can be a deeply spiritual endeavor and can transform their view of the world. They are, without knowing it, near the threshold of a basic choice, a choice that only they can make. As Morpheus says to Neo, "I can only show you the door. You're the one that has to walk through it." This book is an attempt to show people the door, give them some idea of what lies beyond it, and explain from a scientific standpoint why what lies beyond it has a stronger claim to being real than the world they're familiar with. 2. Paradoxes of Meditation. I'm not supposed to tell you about my first big success at meditating. The reason is that there isn't supposed to be success at meditating. As any good meditation teacher will tell you, if you talk about meditation in terms of success or failure, you're misunderstanding what meditation is. Here I must depart from orthodoxy. I wouldn't advocate meditation if I didn't think there was something people could achieve by it. and if people don't achieve that something, well, that would constitute failure, right? As in, the opposite of success. Granted, it may be best for people who are meditating to not think about succeeding. But that's because thinking about succeeding gets in the way of success. And granted, if you do achieve meditative success, that may lead to a new frame of mind that is less caught up in the pursuit of success than your old frame of mind, less relentlessly focused on achieving certain kinds of distant material goals, more aware of the here and now. In sum, you can best achieve success at meditation by not pursuing success. And achieving this success may mean caring less about success, at least as success is conventionally defined. If this sounds unbearably paradoxical, maybe you should quit listening here, because this won't be the last time we find paradox in Buddhist practice or Buddhist teachings. Then again, there's paradoxical stuff in modern physics. An electron is both a particle and a wave, and modern physics works fine. So you might as well keep listening. Anyway, before I violate protocol by telling you about my first big success as a meditator, I have to commit another violation of protocol by noting what a naturally bad meditator I am. That you shouldn't talk about how bad you are at meditating is a straightforward corollary of the axiom that there's no such thing as succeeding or failing at meditating. And if I'm violating the axiom, I might as well violate its corollary. So here it goes. Suppose you ranked all the people in the world in terms of their likelihood of picking up mindfulness meditation easily, sitting down, focusing on the breath, and slowly sinking into a state of calm, dispassionate observation. At one point of the spectrum, you'd have Bobby Knight, the college basketball coach, famous for his red, furious face and for flinging a chair onto a basketball court. At the other end, you'd have, I don't know, the Dalai Lama or maybe the late Mr. Rogers. On this spectrum, I would be much closer to Bobby Knight than to the Dalai Lama or Mr. Rogers. I've never thrown a chair onto a basketball court, but I threw a chicken leg at a dinner guest when I was 4 and a baseball bat at a brother-in-law when I was 12. Happily, my penchant for throwing things at people has waned with age, but the underlying volatility hasn't entirely disappeared. And volatility doesn't smooth the path toward mindfulness. Plus, and perhaps relatedly, there's my attitude toward other human beings, which could get in the way of the metta, or loving-kindness, that you're supposed to deploy during a certain kind of meditation. Michael Kinsley, who was editor of The New Republic when I worked there many years ago, suggested, not even half-jokingly, that I should write a column called The Misanthrope. Actually, I think that oversimplifies my problem. I don't have a hostile disposition toward humankind, per se. In fact, I feel quite warmly toward humankind. It's individual humans I have trouble with. I'm prone to a certain skepticism about people's motives and character, and this critical appraisal can harden into enduringly harsh judgment. I'm particularly tough on people who disagree with me on moral or political issues that I consider important. Once I place these people on the other side of a critical ideological boundary, I can have trouble thinking generous and sympathetic thoughts about them. On top of all this, there's my attention deficit disorder. Meditation is hard enough even if you have normal skills of concentration. I don't. Here's an interesting thing about this hypothetical spectrum of people ranked from most likely meditators to least likely meditators. The least likely meditators are the people who seem to most need the benefits of meditation. Personally, I think that if the Dalai Lama had never started meditating, he'd still be a pretty easy guy to get along with. I don't think he was born with a lot of rough edges that needed sanding down. So too with Mr. Rogers. Bobby Knight and I are another story altogether. Hence, another paradox of meditation. The problems that meditation can help you overcome often make it hard to meditate in the first place. Yes, meditation may help you lengthen your attention span, dampen your rage, and view your fellow human beings less judgmentally. Unfortunately, a short attention span, a hot temper, and a penchant for harsh judgment may slow your progress along the meditative path. That is bad news for me. But there's an upside to my possessing this rich array of impediments to meditation. They make me a good laboratory rat, a kind of stand-in for the rest of humankind. After all, even if I score higher on these scales than the average person, most people score much higher on them than is optimal. And it may well be that the average person scores higher on them than used to be the case. Technologies of distraction have made attention deficits more common. And there's something about the modern environment, something technological or cultural or political or all of the above, that seems conducive to harsh judgment and ready rage. Just look at all the tribalism, the discord, and even open conflict among religious, ethnic, national, and ideological lines. More and more, it seems, groups of people define their identity in terms of sharp opposition to other groups of people. I consider this tribalism the biggest problem of our time. I think it could undo millennia of movement toward global integration, unravel the social web just when a technology has brought the prospect of a cohesive planetary community within reach. Given that the world is still loaded with nuclear weapons, and that biotechnology is opening a Pandora's box of new weaponry, you can imagine our tribalistic impulses ushering in a truly dark age. Or maybe I'm getting carried away. Anyway, I'll spare you the full-length, high-volume version of my sermon about our imperiled planet. You don't have to share my apocalyptic fears to think that it would be good for the world if meditation could help more people overcome the mental tendencies that sustain the more belligerent forms of tribalism. And if it can help me overcome them, help me tamp down rage and contemplate my enemies, real and imagined, more calmly, it can help just about anyone overcome them. That's what makes me such an exemplary laboratory rat. I am a walking embodiment of what I consider to be the biggest problem facing humanity. I am, in microcosm, what's wrong with the world. My career as a laboratory rat began in earnest when I went to that retreat in rural Massachusetts in August 2003. I decided that meditation was worth exploring, but I had learned that casual experimentation wouldn't get a person like me very far. Boot camp was in order. So I signed up for a 7-day retreat at the Insight Meditation Society, auspiciously located on Pleasant Street in the town of Barrie. There, every day, I would do sitting meditation for a total of 5.5 hours and walking meditation for about that long. As for the rest of the day, when you add 3 silent meals, a 1-hour yogi job in the morning, vacuuming hallways in my case, and listening to one of the teachers give a Dharma talk in the evening, you've pretty much exhausted the day, which is good because if there was time you needed to waste, the traditional means of wasting it wouldn't be available. There was no TV, no internet, no news from the outside world, and you're not supposed to bring books to read or do any writing. That last rule I secretly broke so that I'd have a record of events. I wasn't planning to write this book at that point, but I'm a writer, and I consider pretty much everything I do grist for my mill. And of course, no talking. This daily regimen may not sound taxing, since, aside from the yogi job, it doesn't involve anything we normally call work. But the first couple of days were pretty excruciating. Have you ever tried sitting on a cushion with your legs crossed, focusing on your breath? It's no picnic, especially if you're as bad at focusing on your breath as I am. Early in the retreat, I could go a whole 45-minute meditation session without ever sustaining focus for 10 consecutive breaths. And I know because I was counting. Time and again, after I counted 3 or 4 breaths, my mind would wander, and then eventually I'd realize that I had lost count, or in some cases, that I was still going through the motions of counting, but was in fact thinking about something else and not consciously feeling the breaths. It didn't help that I got mad at myself every time this happened. Madder and madder as the first couple of days wore on. Naturally, my anger then extended to all the people who seemed to be doing better than I was, which was around 80 people. That is, everybody. Imagine being stuck for a week with 80 people who are doing better than you, people who succeed while you fail, or at least succeed while you fail. My big breakthrough. My big breakthrough came on the fifth morning of the retreat. After breakfast, I consumed a bit too much of the instant coffee I had brought, and as I tried to meditate, I felt the classic symptom of overcaffeination, a very unpleasant tension in my jaw that made me feel like grinding my teeth. This feeling kept intruding on my focus, and after trying for a while to fight the intrusion, I finally just surrendered to it and shifted my attention to the tension in my jaw. Or maybe it wasn't so much a shifting of attention as an expansion of attention. Staying conscious of my breath, but letting it recede into the background as this annoying jaw sensation moved to center stage. This sort of readjustment of attention, by the way, is a perfectly fine thing to do. In mindfulness meditation, as it's typically taught, the point of focusing on your breath isn't just to focus on your breath. It's to stabilize your mind, to free it of its normal preoccupations so you can observe things that are happening in a clear, unhurried, less reactive way. And things that are happening emphatically includes things happening inside your mind. Feelings arise within you, sadness, anxiety, annoyance, relief, joy, and you try to experience them from a different vantage point than is usual, neither clinging to the good feelings nor running away from the bad ones, but rather just experiencing them straightforwardly and observing them. This altered perspective can be the beginning of a fundamental and enduring change in your relationship to your feelings. You can, if all goes well, cease to be their slave. After devoting some attention to the over-caffeinated feeling in my jaw, I suddenly had an angle on my interior life that I'd never had before. I remember thinking something like, yes, the grinding sensation is still there, the sensation I typically define as unpleasant. But that sensation is down there in my jaw, and that's not where I am. I'm up here in my head. I was no longer identifying with the feeling. I was viewing it objectively, I guess you could say. In the space of a moment, it had entirely lost its grip on me. It was a very strange thing to have an unpleasant feeling cease to be unpleasant without really going away. There is a paradox here. Don't say I didn't warn you. When I first expanded my attention to encompass the obnoxiously intrusive jaw-grinding sensation, this involved relaxing my resistance to the sensation. I was, in a sense, accepting, even embracing, a feeling that I had been trying to keep at a distance. But the result of this closer proximity to the feeling was to acquire a kind of distance from it, a certain degree of detachment, or, as some meditation teachers prefer for somewhat technical reasons to put it, non-attachment. This is something that can happen again and again via meditation. Accepting, even embracing, an unpleasant feeling can give you a critical distance from it that winds up diminishing the unpleasantness. In fact, one thing I occasionally do when I'm feeling very sad, and this is something you can experiment with, even if you've never meditated, is sit down, close my eyes, and study the sadness. Accept its presence, and just observe how it actually makes me feel. For example, it's kind of interesting that, though I may not be close to actually crying, the feeling of sadness does have a strong presence right around the parts of my eyes that would get active if I did start crying. I'd never noticed that before meditating on sadness. This careful observation of sadness, combined with a kind of acceptance of it, does, in my experience, make it less unpleasant. Now here's a question that is fundamental. Which, if either of my two perceptions, was truer? When the feeling felt unpleasant, or when the unpleasantness subsided and the feeling became, for practical purposes, neutral? To put it another way, was the initial unpleasantness in any sense an illusion? Certainly by adopting another perspective, I made it disappear, and that's something that's often true of what we call illusions. Shifting your perspective dispels them. But are there any additional grounds for thinking of it as an illusion? This question goes way beyond my own little episodes of transcending overcaffeination and melancholy. It applies, in principle, to all negative feelings, fears, anxieties, loathing, self-loathing, and more. Imagine if our negative feelings, or at least lots of them, turned out to be illusions, and we could dispel them by just contemplating them from a particular vantage point. Pain that doesn't hurt. There's no doubt that meditation training has allowed some people to become essentially indifferent to what otherwise would have been unbearable pain. In June of 1963, a monk named Thich Quang Duc staged a public protest of the South Vietnamese government's treatment of Buddhists. On a cushion placed in a Saigon street, he assumed the lotus position. After another monk poured gasoline over him, Duc said, "Before closing my eyes and moving towards the vision of the Buddha, I respectfully plead to President Ngo Dinh Diem to take a mind of compassion towards the people of the nation and implement religious equality to maintain the strength of the homeland eternally." Then he lit a match. The journalist David Halberstam, who witnessed the event, wrote, "As he burned, he never moved a muscle, never uttered a sound. His outward composure in sharp contrast to the wailing people around him." Now you might argue that Duc, far from liberating himself from an illusion, was actually suffering from an illusion. After all, the fact is that he was burning to death. So if he lacked the sensation we normally associate with burning to death, a sensation that carries intense pain and triggers alarm that would strike most of us as appropriate, then isn't there some sense in which he wasn't getting the picture? The question I'm circling around, which of our normal feelings, thoughts, and perceptions are in some sense illusions, is important for two reasons. One reason is simple and practical. Obviously, if many unpleasant feelings, feelings of anxiety, fear, self-loathing, melancholy, and so on, are in some sense illusions, and we can use meditation to dispel them, or at least weaken their grip on us, that's news you can use. The other reason is at first glance more academic, but it ultimately has a kind of practical value as well. Figuring out when our feelings mislead us will help shed light on the question of whether the Buddhist view of the mind and of the mind's relationship to reality is as crazy as it sometimes sounds. Is perceived reality, or a sizable chunk of it, really an illusion? This question takes us into depths of Buddhist philosophy that aren't often plumbed in popular accounts of meditation. Naturally enough, these accounts tend to focus on things with a near-term payoff, stress reduction, boosting self-esteem, and so on, without getting deeply into the philosophical context in which Buddhist meditation arose and within which it has flourished. Using meditation this way, as a purely therapeutic device that doesn't deeply change your view of reality, is a perfectly fine thing to do. It's good for you, and it will probably be good for the world. Still, using meditation this way isn't, by itself, taking the red pill. Taking the red pill means asking basic questions about the relationship of the perceiver to the perceived, and examining the underpinnings of our normal view of reality. If you're thinking seriously about taking the red pill, you'll be curious as to whether the Buddhist view of the world works, not just in a therapeutic sense, but in a more philosophical sense. Does this Buddhist perspective, with its seemingly topsy-turvy conception of what's real and what's not, make any sense in light of modern science? That's the question I'll take up in the next chapter, and indeed in much of the rest of this book. As we'll see, this question, though important on purely philosophical grounds, also has implications for how we live our lives. Implications that, though in a sense practical, are probably better described as spiritual than as therapeutic. But first, a word of caution. Strictly speaking, there is no Buddhist view of the world. Buddhism began to split into different schools of interpretation not long after it arose, around the middle of the first millennium BCE. As a result, just as there are Catholic and Protestant Christians and Sunni and Shia Muslims, there are distinct branches of Buddhist thought that differ on particular points of doctrine. The most basic division in Buddhism is between the Theravada school and the Mahayana school. My own meditative tradition, Vipassana, derives from the Theravada lineage. It is within the Mahayana lineage, to which Kwanduk belonged, that you find the most radically broad conception of illusion. Some Mahayana Buddhists even subscribe to a mind-only doctrine that, in its more extreme incarnations, dismisses the things we perceive via consciousness as, pretty literally, figments of our imagination. This strand of Buddhist thought, the strand that most obviously resonates with the movie The Matrix, isn't dominant within Mahayana Buddhism, much less within Buddhism at large. But even mainstream Buddhist thinkers accept some version of the concept of emptiness, a subtle idea that is hard to capture in a few words, or in many words, but certainly holds at a minimum that the things we see when we look out on the world have less in the way of distinct and substantial existence than they seem to have. And then there is the famous Buddhist idea that the self, you know, yourself, myself, is an illusion. In this view, the you that you think of as thinking your thoughts, feeling your feelings, and making your decisions doesn't really exist. In Mahayana Buddhism, for reasons I'll touch on in Chapter 13, the term emptiness is often taken to include the concept of not-self. But in Theravada Buddhism, not-self is typically treated separately from any broader notion of emptiness, a notion that is less prominent in Theravada thinking anyway. Throughout this book, I use the terms not-self and emptiness in a non-overlapping way. Emptiness will be used more narrowly than in the Mahayana tradition, referring only to the world out there. If you put these two fundamental Buddhist ideas together, the idea of not-self and the idea of emptiness, you have a radical proposition. Neither the world inside you nor the world outside you is anything like it seems. Both of these ideas would strike most people as dubious, if not crazy. Then again, since the premise of these ideas is that people are naturally deluded, it would seem perverse to let people's natural reactions to them keep us from exploring them. This book is in no small part an exploration of these two ideas, and what I hope to show is that they make a lot of sense. Both our natural view of the world out there and our natural view of the world in here, the world inside our heads, are deeply misleading. What's more, failing to see these two worlds clearly does lead, as Buddhism holds, to a lot of suffering. And meditation can help us see them more clearly. When I say we're going to be exploring the scientific foundation of a Buddhist worldview, I don't mean scientific foundation in the sense of scientific evidence that meditation can reduce suffering. If you want such evidence, there are lots of studies, readily available and widely reported, that seem to show as much. And I don't mean scientific foundation only in the sense of what's going on in the brain when you're meditating and starting to change your view of reality. Though I will, to be sure, get into some of the more important brain scan studies. I mean scientific foundation in the sense of using all the tools of modern psychology to look at such questions as these. Why and in what particular ways are human beings naturally deluded? How exactly does the delusion work? How does delusion make us suffer? How does it make us make other people suffer? Why would the Buddhist prescription for dispelling the delusion, in particular the meditative part of that prescription, work? And what would it mean for it to work fully? In other words, does the elusive state that is said to lie at the culmination of the meditative path, sometimes called enlightenment, really qualify for that term? What would it be like to see the world with perfect clarity? And speaking of the world, is saving the world, keeping the psychology of tribalism from covering the planet in chaos and bloodshed, really a matter of just clarifying the vision of the world's people? I shouldn't say just, because obviously, if delusion is deeply ingrained in us, then dispelling it will take work. Still, it would be nice to know if the struggle for enduring peace is also the struggle for truth. As long as we're undertaking a task as Herculean as saving the world, it would be great to kill two birds with one stone. It would also be nice to think that when people pursue the path to liberation, use meditation to try and see the world more clearly, and in the process reduce their suffering. They are helping humanity broadly. That the quest for individual salvation